Hello, and welcome to another NABBW teleseminar on a topic we Boomer women want and actually need to know more about. Tonight, our goal is to help Boomers get wise about your fiduciary responsibility, or to say that in plain English, tonight we're going to be talking about what you need to know in order to responsibly manage other people's money. My name is Ann Holmes. I'm your moderator and the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, an organization dedicated to educating and empowering women at midlife. This call, like those we do every month, is one of the ways we serve our membership. In a moment, I will introduce our guest expert, Pamela J. Sams, CRPC, a Chartered Retirement Planning Counselor and NABBW's Retirement Planning Associate, to start our discussion titled Boomers Managing Other People's Money. Those of you who listen often know that Pamela J. Sams, CRPC, is a frequent guest and always covers important information related to money and financial planning. Pam is an expert in personal finance. She's spent more than a dozen years helping women and their families improve their personal and financial wealth through solid financial planning. More importantly, Pam is president of Jackson Sams Financial Services, a financial planning and wealth management firm located in Herndon, Virginia, near the Dulles Corridor. There, she focuses on helping women understand the importance of financial and retirement planning by placing their needs first. A graduate of the University of Missouri-Columbia, Pam holds an MBA in financial management from Everett University. She's earned several client service and financial planning awards and successfully earned her CRPC, again, that's Chartered Retirement Planning Counselor certification, through the College of Financial Planning. In the past, Pam and I have talked about the many aspects of aging which are impacted by finances. We've often discussed that boomers aren't doing a good job of planning the financial strategies that they'll need to make retirement possible, which is why we've committed to holding one teleseminar a month on retirement planning topics. And our topic tonight, handling fiduciary responsibilities, is something that I believe many of us will need to address. And most likely, few of us already know what's involved. I know I don't feel up to the prospect of helping my parents manage their finances, and they do need help with their finances. And so in our family, we've designated my brother, who's got an MBA in finance, as the person to work with them on their trust decisions and involve him in their financial decisions. But not everyone has a brother with that background, and sometimes the responsibility to help with the finances falls upon someone like me who doesn't know even what the word fiduciary really means. So clearly this is a topic that Pam can help us grapple with because it's, once again, a topic that's related to money and how we can make the most of it. So let's get to the big question first, Pam. And, of course, before I say that, I should say, hi, Pam, how are you?
Hi, Ann, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well on this wintry, cold February that seems like it's never going to end.
Exactly. We got one more day left in February, and then we're on to March, and I'm just not sure where the year has gone. We're already in the third month, almost in the third month of the year, and wow, time flies by, I guess. I guess time flies by when you're having fun, huh?
Right. All right. Well, now that we are having fun here and we're talking about this topic, I really have to tell you that fiduciary is a word that I hear people throw around a lot, but it's not a word that I really understand. And I think it is a person can be named a fiduciary, but there's also the thing of having a fiduciary responsibility. So let's start at the beginning. And what is a fiduciary?
Yeah, I know a lot of times people hear that fiduciary word thrown around. Really, it's a person that's named to manage either money and or property for someone else. So in that capacity, automatically, you're a fiduciary at that point. So the role of fiduciary carries with it a lot of legal responsibilities. You explained a little bit before with your brother, and he's taking care of your parents and their money. But it also takes a lot of legal responsibilities. So as a fiduciary, you know, you must be, number one, trustworthy. You have to find somebody that's trustworthy, honest, and an act in good faith on your behalf. So if you're going to find a fiduciary for yourself, those are some of the characteristics that you want to look for. And if you do not meet those particular standards, if you don't think you meet those particular standards, you should also, you know, remove yourself from a fiduciary because you don't want to end up in a situation where you're either sued or you have to repay money and things like that. So you want to make sure you are up to the task when you are named a fiduciary, and or if you're naming someone to be a fiduciary for yourself. So you may want to make sure they're trustworthy, they're honest, act in good faith on your behalf and in your best interest. You know, that's why it's really so important to remember, because it's not just your money that you're dealing with. So when you're taking care of somebody else's money, it's not your money, so you have to make sure you do the best thing in the best interest of that person.
Okay. All right. I've got a few more questions about what type of education you might need to have a fiduciary, but maybe you're going to get into that if we would just start by asking the next question is, what types of fiduciaries are there?
Well, there are a variety of different types. I'm going to cover probably four tonight. And fall into the most common categories of fiduciaries. The most common one most people hear is power of attorney. So with the power of attorney, it's actually a legal document that you do have to sign. In the power of attorney, that gives that person the legal authority to make decisions about property or money for that the person that they're being the fiduciary for. So that means you can make decisions if that person is sick or injured. In some states, that document may also be called a durable power of attorney. So it really just kind of depends on the state. But power of attorney, durable power of attorney are basically the interchangeable depending on what state you're in. So under a power of attorney, you know, that person that you are a power of attorney for, they're called the principal. So if you're a power of attorney, the person that you're a power of attorney for is called the principal, and you act as an agent. So you may hear if you have a power of attorney over someone's money or property that you're called the agent. And then another name for that agent may also be called attorney in fact. So there's a lot of different different terms.
Yes.
That people use. So if you're thinking about power of attorney, durable power of attorney, basically the same thing, just kind of depends on where you are with your state. And then agent or attorney, in fact, they're basically also the same type of term for the same person. And then you also have a healthcare power of attorney, those that basically name someone to make decisions about your healthcare. And I think we had talked about that in a couple of different phone calls where we talked about basically having a living will so people could have authority or just make decisions over your health care. So the type of the first one basically being the power of attorney. So the other type of fiduciary would be what we call trustees under a revocable living trust. That means someone named them to manage money and their property. So you're basically a trustee under a revocable living trust. So you name a trustee to your trust. So if you have a trust set up, you would just name a trustee for that. So that's another type of fiduciary. In order to obtain certain services from government agencies, there's also another fiduciary called representative payees or veterans or VA fiduciaries. So those are government agencies that are named to manage government money that is paid to someone. So you may have some representative payees for government that a government agency appoints to oversee the government money part. And then you also have guardians and conservatorships, and these are court names. The court actually names the person to manage the money or property for someone who needs help. So if you didn't pick somebody and you become incapacitated, the courts can step in and say, okay, we're going to appoint a guardian or a conservator to be your fiduciary for you. So, you know, to recap, we have the power of attorney, we have the trustees under a revocable living trust, any representative payees for VA fiduciaries, for government agencies, and then court-appointed guardians or conservators.
All right. And I've heard of the court-appointed guardian also in the terms of care of a minor, you know, when a parent might die or a child is orphaned, there could be a court-appointed situation there with a guardian. So,
yes,
so I guess what you're saying, the guardian doesn't only apply to children, it applies to anyone where you have a responsibility for handling financial decisions.
That's correct. So in the absence of, let's say, you have an elderly parent who's living on their own and you may not be around, or, you know, somebody's distant from them and they're by themselves – the court may step in and say, okay, we need to appoint a guardian or conservator to this person to work on their behalf. So that not just the minors, but also, you know, adults who need assistance in this type of area.
Excellent. Well, I knew about the healthcare power of attorney because, again, going back to my parents, I have the healthcare POA, but my brother, the financial smart guy, is the one who has to deal with meeting with their accountants and all of that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
I'm glad to cede that responsibility off to him because I think that he must feel an immense responsibility with that. But let's talk a little bit about, speaking of the responsibility, what are the duties of a fiduciary?
Well, you know, just to talk a little bit about what I mentioned before, really making sure you're trustworthy and you're acting good faith for the person that you are managing their money. So as a fiduciary, there are basically four basic duties that you need to keep in mind. Number one, you need to act only in that person's best interest. You remember, again, it's their money, it's not your money. So act in that person's best interest. You have to manage money and property carefully. Make sure you do that. Keep money and property separate from yours. So if you're going to manage someone else's money, you can't commingle these things. Make sure their money and their property is separate from yours. And then the last one would be to keep good records, because you have to do a lot of these, you know, help them with their tax returns or filing certain documents. So make sure you keep good records. So act in the person's best interest, manage money and property carefully, keep everything separate from yours, so no commingling, and then also keep good records. So those are the four basic duties of a fiduciary.
All right. Now that we've covered what are their basic duties, can there be situations where a person or a couple might have multiple fiduciaries? I guess I'm thinking that there must be, since I just told you about the situation that my parents have with my brother and me.
Exactly, and that's what I was going to say, just to mention your situation, is that someone who is good at doing the money may do the power of attorney and the legal or the money part of it, and then someone may handle the healthcare end of making decisions for that, and then there may be an accountant that's involved in doing various different things. So there can be multiple fiduciaries that you have. So other fiduciaries, you know, may have authority to make the decisions basically in their particular area. So, for example, you may have a guardian of property, a representative of payee who handles, let's say, health care benefits, or your VA fiduciary who handles the veterans benefits. So it's really important to work with these other fiduciaries to keep them informed on what's going on. So let's say, I guess, for example, if you're kind of a football team. So one may be a quarterback, and then we'll have these other players that's involved in making other decisions for their particular position or their area, and then we have one big central person who makes the decisions. So you must coordinate with all the fiduciaries to share information about decisions that are made, and even if there are other fiduciaries that don't agree on all the decisions, because there will be that particular situation, you really need to let the agent do, you know, don't let that particular person do something that's going to harm the person that you're managing money for. So you are still responsible if you're the kind of the quarterback and coordinating all of these fiduciaries. You are still responsible for them and must act in the best interest as well. So you basically make sure everybody is well informed, share information on decisions, and do a coordination of it, even though they may have their particular decision making in their particular area of expertise, either be the benefits of Social Security or veterans benefits or the power of attorney to, you know, sign documents and things like that. So you have to really make sure that everything is coordinated and share information back and forth. That's probably the best thing to do. You want to make sure everybody's involved in the process and not making decisions in a vacuum. So make sure that across the board, everybody's informed.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the process, and that was something that I was starting to think about as you were describing all of these. How does the whole process, when in a person's life, I mean, say that we're talking now, I've kind of presented this as perhaps you might be named as a fiduciary for a parent, but mm-hmm. as we're boomers, we're, you know, adults and have children perhaps there's a time that you advise people that you work with, when is a good time to start thinking about putting this team together?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you're getting closer to, you know, towards aging, towards retirement, you want to start thinking about who's going to handle certain things in the event that something happened to you. Of course, if you're married, of course, the spouse is going to take care of a lot of that. But if you're by yourself, this is probably the good time when you start thinking about your overall retirement plan, putting some of these things in place. I think on several phone calls, we always revisit the estate planning situation. So really getting mm-hmm. these particular documents in place and naming these individuals and who can act as a fiduciary for you. Because, you know, like you said, you may not necessarily be good with the money, but your brother is. So he's a good candidate for the power of attorney piece, and you're a good candidate for the health care decisions. So mm-hmm. as you're getting your documents and your overall financial plan, the estate planning piece and your retirement plan and who's going to handle a lot of this, if you become incapacitated or as you start to age, you may want to start thinking about these particular people and who can you go to and lean on and make sure you know, back again, looking at some of those criteria, somebody that's trustworthy, somebody that acts in their best interest, and then basically somebody who wants to do it. That's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people go, well, you know, such and such is going to take care of me after I need nursing care or I need to go into a facility. And maybe daughter doesn't want to handle that particular thing. So you have to have these conversations up front. Say, okay, I'm thinking about this. What do you think? And then that gives that person an opportunity to, I guess, get an out for themselves. Say, you know, I appreciate you thinking about me, but I may not be up to the task. And then mm-hmm. that way you can kind of start thinking about maybe an alternative to that person. So you want to start thinking about that, you know, like I said, a little bit prior to retirement, but of course as you're aging, getting this team in place for these players that will be able to act as a fiduciary for you.
All right. Now, who would be a good person to start with to start assembling your team? Is that something that you might work with your attorney or your accountant with to where they might recommend people to you, or do most people tend to look toward their family for taking on some of these responsibilities? How would you quarterback such a mm-hmm. team getting put together?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first, you know, there is probably the first you're going to look with, you know, family and friends because they're the closest to you. That will be able to handle most of the basic duties. Some that will require a little bit specialized type of knowledge. You know, and I think we're going to talk a little bit about this as well a little bit later. You may want to also get recommendations for accountants or attorneys or things like that from people you already have in place or your financial advisor or maybe family and friends that will be able to recommend. So those particular professionals that have specialized skills, you need to start to interview and make sure those people are going to be in place along with the rest of the team to be able to help assist you with accounting pieces or legal documents or things that you need to put in place as well. But I guess just to kind of go back to the question is really look at starting with, you know, family and friends first. If you have a relationship with a financial advisor, you probably want to speak with that person as well, along with other professionals that you may already have in place. That's a good place to start as well. But most people generally start with their family and friends.
All right. Well, that leads me to my next question, Pam, actually, is you know, one of the things I was thinking about as you were discussing this is people being people. There's sometimes animosities or, you know, this person doesn't like that person or doesn't have that trust, which is the first word you keep mentioning is the importance of trust. So as a person is putting together their team, or if you are a person looking at the situation that your parents have put into place, how can you avoid having problems with family and friends, maybe the ones who aren't named to the team?
Yeah, and that's always a delicate situation because there's always family dynamics. I mean, in any situation, I'm sure, you know, at family dinners or whenever people get together, somebody's going to rub against somebody wrong in these mm-hmm. particular situations. And when it comes to important decisions like who's going to be a fiduciary, who's going to take care of, you know, parents or make these decisions, some of that comes into play. So family and friends, of course, are not going to agree with every decision that you're going to make with money and property if you're named to be fiduciary. So really to help reduce some of the friction, you know, I would follow the four duties described above and, you know, really looking at what I talked about, the four basic duties, act in the best interest, making sure you separate things like that as a guideline that you're given. And then sharing information helps, so really getting everybody on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
So sharing information. So, like I said, never make decisions in a vacuum, especially if siblings or the rest of the family want to know what's going on. But if you're a fiduciary for aging parents, you want to make sure everybody's on the same page. So you don't want to keep any secrets or anything in the dark. So, you know, you may want to share some accounting or prepare summaries or, you know, how money was spent, because that's always the topic of discussion is that what's going on. I don't know. I can't see what's going on with the money. How do I know you're not buying a new car? How do I know you're mm-hmm. not doing this? So really looking at sharing those accountings, prepare summaries and statements of how money was spent, unless, you know, you're told otherwise. So, mm-hmm. you know, your parents may have said, okay, you're handling this. I don't want, you know, Cheryl to know about what's going on, you know. So
mm-hmm.
unless you're told not to, you should probably provide summaries on how money was spent. It's usually easier to deal with questions about decisions when they happen rather than deal with it afterwards, because there's always suspicion and there's anger that builds up over time. So if everything is out in the open from the beginning, you don't have this shadow of suspicion and anger that will eventually arise and blow up or something at Thanksgiving dinner. So you don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
So really in the end, of course, you're always going to make the final decisions, but make sure you are sharing information as you go along.
Mm-hmm.
Especially about the money piece, because that, like I said, usually is a really source of problems, because let's say one sibling may not have as many resources and you're named fiduciary, and then you have this coming up. How do they know that you didn't buy that particular item with the monies that you were supposed to be fiduciary over? So
mm-hmm.
if you have outlined expenses, there's nothing that will be able to pop up and I guess come back and bite you. So really kind of making sure you have that outline. So some family may be so difficult that no matter how much information that you share with them, so use your best judgment. But if you really don't agree and it becomes a very tense situation, you may want to have somebody help sort it out. So maybe going to a mediator or a family counselor or somebody that's able to, kind of a third party that's
mm-hmm.
able to come in and kind of mediate the situation if it gets so difficult that you're not able to handle anything and they're not
mm-hmm.
agreeing or with any decisions and they don't want to hear anything, you may want to bring a third party on with that. But I think, you know, kind of the open architecture of really sharing the information, providing summaries of itemized on how money is spent, sharing with them this is the decisions that I've made for this particular situation, usually clarifies it a little bit more, so you're not having those suspicions and that anger build up over time.
All right. Now, it seems to me that in some situations when I look back on other family stories that I've heard, it seems to me that sometimes, you know, a trustee might be actually an attorney, or it might be someone who's a representative
mm-hmm.
of your bank, and I'm sure that those people are not serving in this capacity without getting some kind of remuneration for their time and their efforts. So it would seem to me that therefore, if you named someone who was a son or daughter into one of these positions, that it could be possible that person could also ask to be having a payment for the time that they spend managing they're part of the estate. So is that a unusual thing to have the familial people that are involved be paid? Because I do expect that the professional people are paid.
Yes, the professionals are going to be paid. It's really an option if you have somebody, a family or friend, to take care of it, if it's going to take a considerable amount of time for them and they don't feel comfortable that they're being compensated, or is it taken away from, let's say, their regular occupation or job. They may want to ask for a stipend or something that's paid out of the resources of the money that you're managing. So that would be one of the things that you would an expense item that you would put in on there would be stipend or compensation for trustee, just as if you would if you went to hire a professional the same way. So, yes, that could be done. And then some will just say, okay, I'm doing it, especially if it's your parents. You say, I'm just going to handle it. I'll be named trustee. And you don't have that particular compensation. So some people waive it, but if it is going to be in there, it's basically a line item that needs to be addressed out of what money is going to be paid for that.
Okay. And that needs to be, as you were saying before, clearly spelled out so that there's not any familial rifts where someone is saying, how come, you talked about that new car thing, where did that money for the new car come from? But you know, if it has been agreed that this job is such a sizable amount of time required to manage the work that you've taken on, you would receive payment for it, but that should be something that all the other family siblings, or at least I would think at least siblings, not necessarily all the cousins and grandchildren or anything, but I would think that if it's your parents, that the other siblings would need to know and understand about that.
Exactly, and that's definitely, like I said, basically having everything out and open and shared with siblings if that's the case. Because, like I said, you don't want any extra surprises, and then they find out you're getting, a $10,000 stipend or something yearly to do this. So you don't want that to pop up. So you want to make sure everything is spelled out, everything is itemized, where money is allocated to with that, so you don't have any surprises or anything that pops up that people can hold over your head and say, hey, I didn't know this was going on. And then that swells back up into, a lot of suspicion, a lot of anger on what's going on. So if everything is out in the open and everything is spelled out and everything is itemized, then, there shouldn't be any issue. But definitely make sure it's out and open.
All right. Excellent. Now, we talked about involving professionals. I just mentioned, for example, selecting an attorney or an accountant to be someone who would be on the team because of that person's particular expertise. Is there things that we should be aware of when we work with professionals in this capacity as a fiduciary?
Exactly. Now, when you're managing someone else's affairs, you really want to make sure if you're not an expert in these areas and you need help, that you go get a professional. So lawyers, of course, financial advisors, accountants, any real estate agents, appraisals, anybody that will be able to handle any particular situation that you're not able to handle is a professional. So basically you pay them money out of the resources that you are managing. But if you do need help from these professionals, you really need to make sure there are a few tips that I want to share with you. Check on the professional's qualifications. Many professionals need to be licensed or registered by government agencies. Make sure you check credentials with government agencies. Make sure the license and registration is current and that the professional is in good standing. And then check any history that's going on. So if you're dealing with any financial advisors or accountants or lawyers, they have to have licenses that are current and make sure they don't have any complaint history or things that are in their background that may not make them suitable to be on the fiduciary team. Also, interview professionals thoroughly and ask a lot of questions. You may want to basically go to maybe about two or three individuals in each category, so maybe three lawyers, three financial advisors, and interview each professional thoroughly and ask questions and make sure you're comfortable with the answers to those. Review any contracts carefully before you make any signings. So before hiring any professionals, get a plan of work first, and then, of course, you're going to expect a and what the expected fee is going to be, so you don't have any surprises pop up on you. So look, ask for a proposed plan before you sign any contracts. And make your, you know, own decisions based on, you know, facts and advice. So listen to their advice, but remember you are the ultimate decision maker. So basically you're using them as a guide or an advisor, but ultimately you're the decision maker. So take into consideration all of the facts and advice that they give you, but ultimately all of those decisions are yours that you need to make. But really follow those tips, especially when you're dealing with managing someone else's money, and when you're dealing with elder parents or elderly people, qualifications are key, because you have so many people that, you know, want to take advantage of a situation like that. So that's one of the main things I would probably stress is check credentials, check qualifications, interview them thoroughly, and ask as many questions as you want that you feel comfortable, and never sign anything. Make sure you review all of the contracts before signing and hiring that professional and making your own decisions ultimately with their advice.
And I think that's extremely important. I was looking at a recent issue of AARP that, not the actual magazine, but that newsletter that they put out, and it was seeming to be having an article that was about financial exploitation and how all of us can be exploited, you know, but that somehow those people who are out there to exploit people tend to pick on elderly people, seeming to think that we might have, you know, fewer capabilities to realize that we're being taken. So how would you advise that a person would go about looking out for financial exploitation?
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, and like you said, several articles and AARP newsletter, and, you know, just out on the internet, a lot of publications. You know, just to share a story, my own mother was a victim of one of these financial exploitation scams that were going on, with someone would call up and say, we need your, you know, send a check and you can win $50,000 and things like that, you know. So, you know, it happens all of the time. So really making sure you're keen on this, and also educating your parents or the person that you're handling the money for, that this is rampant and it's going on, and to kind of look out for what's going on. But family, friends, neighbors, caregivers, fiduciary, you know, any of the others may try to take advantage of this person. So that's why I want to go back and stress the fiduciary, make sure this person is trustworthy when you pick this person. Because, you know, they can take their money, you know, without the permission, fail to repay what they owe, any services, anything like that. So some examples of financial exploitation or financial abuse, because it's, like I said, it's really rampant out there. And I think some legislation is maybe coming down the road on trying to look at ways to curb this, because it's become such an issue with the elderly now. So as a fiduciary, you can, you know, help protect the person you're managing money for. You should look at a few of these signs of financial exploitation. Really, the person is still control over some of the funds. They can be exploited. So if you have money, but then they still have money, then that's what happened with my mother, is that she still had a checkbook. So she could still write a check. And, you know, what happens is that, you know, they'll take the address and the information, and then they still have her phone number, and they can call her and, you know, go over and over again with these different schemes. So, you know, make sure this person still controls some of the funds that can be exploited. So even if they do not control any of their funds, it still can be exploited. So what you want to take a look at are some of these particular signs. And one of them is, for example, if you think some property or money is missing, so you want to take a look at what's going on. If you notice there are sudden changes in spending and savings, so that they may be becoming a victim of exploitation for their finances. And that's what happened, because I'm here in Virginia, and my mother is still in St. Louis. My oldest, my sister and my brother-in-law, they're handling her expenses and paying her bills and helping her with that, and they noticed some chunks of money missing at this particular time, and what happened, and then she told them, and they're like, no, okay, this probably shouldn't be happening. So really taking a look at changes in spending and saving. Also, if there's lots of money from the bank that's missing without explanation, because sometimes people can get social security numbers or PIN numbers and things like that from ATM, and then there's money missing. If there are large wires of money out of the account, that could be a sign that there's some financial exploitation going on. If they're unable to pay bills that you usually pay because there's money missing, that may be a red flag as well. Using the ATM a lot because, elderly people don't like to go to the ATM. They like to go to the tellers. So if they start using the ATM a lot, then that may be also a sign that there's something going on fishy with exploitation there. Buying things that they don't seem necessary. So they're overspending and they're starting to use some services or things they never used before. That may also be a sign that something's going on. Make sure names on banks or other accounts that you don't recognize and that they're unwilling to explain what's going on. So all of a sudden, your mother's account has somebody else's name on it in addition to their name, and you don't recognize them, and they're not telling you what's going on, then there may be something fishy going on in terms of financial exploitation. They don't get their bank statements or bills because people could be stealing their mail and redirecting mail to their own home, so that could happen. And then also one of the key things, which is really, really, really sad, and it has become to light a lot with elderly people, is people in their own family are doing financial exploitation with them. So really looking at somebody who comes in and they're afraid to tell that particular relative or caregiver or friend, and they don't want anybody else to come visit, or they don't let you take phone calls, or they don't let you speak for themselves. Some of that may be going on, and I believe there was a case with Mickey Rooney when this was going on with one of his relatives that was some financial abuse, was taking money and things like that from him. So there can be actual caregivers and friends and relatives that are really involved with some of this exploitation as well. So if you believe that there's someone out there and there's exploitation taking place, number one, if that person is in immediate danger, make sure you call 911 because you have to make sure that person is safe and secure. So you want to make sure you do that. If you have to get the police or sheriff or authorities involved, make sure you do that. Alert any bank or credit card companies of what's going on, if there's extra spending, the things that you aren't aware of, or the card is out of their possession, make sure you alert those people. And if they're in a nursing home or a facility, the long-term care ombudsman program, they have a control unit. So if something is happening in a nursing home or assisted living facility, it's a state authority that handles those particular financial exploitation cases. So really making sure you're aware of what's going on. It takes a lot of noticing some simple things that just may look out of place. Don't ignore those because it may be something a little bit bigger than what you think it is. So really making sure you keep, and that comes back to keeping good records, knowing what's going on, what's coming in, what's going out, the habits of the person that you're managing money for. If they start to have big expenditures for things or buying things that you're not aware of, or all of a sudden they start using the ATM more, those sort of things. You have to start looking at some of these red flags because they could be a form of, they could be susceptible to financial exploitation because it's, like I said, it's really rampant out there, especially as the population is aging. There's more and more of this coming down the pike. And, those are some of the things that you need to be aware of.
All right. Well, you've also mentioned in most of those cases where to go to get help. Are there any other resources that you would advise for getting help, or have you pretty much covered all the key ones there?
Those are the key ones, but I do want to address a few more consumer scams, because there are some common scams that are out there. Of course, everybody heard of the pigeon drop thing, where everybody, you know, you buy this, you go to the bank, you withdraw a lot of money, you can invest in this, and then you don't see this person ever again. So, you know, a lot of people have fallen susceptible to that particular scam. But as a fiduciary, you should be alert to protect money from any consumer scams as well as any financial exploitation. So there's a lot of criminal and con artists that are out there that have many scams, and they change them over time, all the time, so you have to be aware. They often seek unsuspecting people, which are the elderly, who have access to money. So you really have to make sure that you take a look at that. So learn to spot consumer scams that are against the person you're managing money for and against you also as the fiduciary. So a couple of the common consumer scams is basically a relative in need. So someone in your family who pretends, or someone who pretends to be a family member or a family friend, they call or they email and they say that I'm in need, I need trouble, you need to wire me money right away.
Right.
That's a common scam. So you get an email that says, hey, I'm in distress. Can you wire me $10,000 or whatever? And we need it here. This is the money, the bank information, wire me money. So the relative in need is one of the common consumer scams. Also charity appeals, because, you know, there's all kind of fake charities that are out there. So you get a letter or a call from someone asking for money from a fake charity, either a charity that doesn't exist or a charity that didn't call or write you. So the charity appeal is especially during, I would say later in the year, well, all during the year, but sometimes when people are more charitably inclined, let's say, those scams tend to pop up a little bit more in terms of fake charities being set up. The lottery or sweepstakes, and this is the one, like I said, my mother felt susceptible to. You get a call or you get an email that you have a chance to win a lot of money through a sweepstakes or lottery, and then the caller will offer you tips on how to win, and you pay them a fee or you buy something, and then you send them the money, or at least you get an email saying you already won and you have to give your bank account information or your check or whatever to collect your winnings. That's one of the huge ones that are out there. And like I said, my own mother felt susceptible to that particular lottery sweepstakes scam. And we had to tell her, you know, I think we had to go also change her phone number because they had a phone number. It was, you know, a big mess. So really looking at some of these scams. Any home improvement scams, what happens is this, the scammer takes money for repairs, especially older people who have been in their homes for a long period of time. They may have home improvement projects they need to have done. A person comes by and says, I can redo that repair for you, but you need to give me the money up front. What happens, they never return to the work, or they do bad work, or, you know, sometimes, you know, they break something to create more work, or they say that they, you know, things need to be fixed or don't work, but they do, and they ask for extra money. So look out for home improvement scams. Also, the free trip, you know, you want a free trip, they ask for your credit card number in advance, to have cash to hold the reservation for you. So that's one. Another one's government money. So you call and get a letter from a government agency saying that, you know, you get a refund or a tax refund. And that's going on a lot now, too, especially with the IRS, is that people are filing false returns for people to get refunds. So that's one of the scams. They'll get somebody's Social Security number and file a whole false return to get your refund. So that happens. So making sure you keep your credit card, I mean, your Social Security number safe. Drug plans even, you know, scammers pretend that they're with Medicare, prescription drug plan. They try to sell you a Medicare discount card, and they ask for money or send a check to get the drug plan. And they're not, you know, soliciting. Or if they're soliciting through mail, email, phone calls, especially during the open enrollment period when people have to sign up for Medicare during October to December timeframe, this is a popular scam that will pop up. Identity theft is still one of those big ones that a lot of people fall susceptible to. Your name, birth date, social security number, your account numbers, everything is stolen a lot of times. And then they'll, you know, create credit cards, open up mortgages in your name. You know, it's a mess going on with identity theft these days. And then fake mail, scammers send letters or emails that look like they're from legitimate banks or businesses or agencies, and they're requesting personal information or bank account information. And so I always tell people, if you never answer, if somebody calls you on the phone and they're asking you for bank account information or social security number, you know, basically take their number and say, I will call you back. And then you call them at a number, and if it doesn't sound right when you call that person back and you don't get a legitimate business-sounding greeting, you don't want to get out that particular piece of information. So really never get out those information that people call you for. Because your bank would never require you to give out your bank account number or your personal information over the phone, same thing with your Social Security number. And that's one of the things you really have to make sure you protect. Never carry a copy of your Social Security card on your person, in your purse or your wallet, because those are some of the big things that people are stealing these days in order to create whole different identities under you. So the identity theft is really big with people stealing Social Security cards out of people's purses or wallets, so never carry your card with you.
That's excellent advice. I know for a while I had a contractor that out of the country contractor that was doing programming work for us, and I paid them by Western Union because that the country that they were in, that was at the time, he didn't have like a PayPal account or anything like that that I could, so the only way I could send money to him was by Western Union. And when I would go to the bank, where I went to, not my bank, but another bank in town, that is where I sent my Western Unions from, they always required a second form of ID from me. And one of the ones that they would accept is a Social Security number. And I was always amazed that they thought that I should and they're a bank.
Yeah.
I should trust them, and yet I felt really questioning about telling them what my Social Security number was, especially because you never know what happens to the paper, you know, after they fill out the form. So
exactly,
that always really
yeah.
made me very nervous. Now you haven't talked about another type of scam which we tend to see on TV, so I suppose copywriters or scriptwriters like it, but I do think it also happens in real life, and that's the romantic type of situation.
Yeah, you get a lot of that as well with these scams that you'll get somebody, you know, these scammers and con artists are really good at what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you get involved with somebody, you know, for a period of time, next thing you know, you wake up and then they're gone or something, and then your bank account is gone with them. So making sure you don't fall for these particular situations, and know this, you know, try to learn as much as you can about these particular people that come into your life without, you know, really taking, because these people will take advantage of it. That's what they do as con artists and scammers. They take advantage of people who are susceptible to this type of scam. So really trying to be as alert and aware as possible when you're dealing with other people.
Well, one thing that I would like to ask you about, if I could ask a question, unless there's more of this other part that you wanted to talk about, which is the scams. Have we covered all the scams?
Yep, we covered all the scams.
Okay. So we'll cut you off.
So where to go for help? We talked a little bit about that before you asked me the question. But it's a website, www.eldercare.gov. They have a lot of information on adult protective services. It's the Agency on Aging and Disability Resource Center is located on there as well. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program is on there as well. Better Business Bureau is also a good resource to go to look for people. If, you know, people come and say, I'm this type of business, you can always look them up and find out information on them. They should be looked at with the Better Business Bureau if they're a legitimate business. Mm-hmm. If you need any mediators, there's a listing of local mediators on a website called www.acrnet.org. Those are mediators, so if you need a family mediator for that. Of course, Medicaid and Medicare fraud, you would go to the eldercare.gov as well as medicare.gov to, you know, to report any fraudulent Medicaid or Medicare with that. And, of course, you know, your local police or sheriff will be able to help you with anything that requires them to look in on the person that is in immediate danger. So if this person is being threatened or as a family member or an outside friend or somebody, and then and that particular person doesn't feel comfortable, make sure you get some police involved in that particular situation as well. You don't want any harassment going on, because that's what happens with a lot of these either family or friends. They'll become it's more of a scare tactic. You know, if you give me this amount of money, I won't tell this person. So making sure that person is safe, call law enforcement agencies and get them involved if you need to. So those are basically, and of course, if you suspect that there's mail fraud going on, let's check the Postal Inspector Service as well, if you suspect somebody is stealing your mail or there's mail fraud going on. So those are a few places to get help.
Excellent. Good advice there. Now, I've got a question that's come in here from people that are listening, and that is, what if you don't trust or don't have a good relationship with the person who's been named fiduciary in the estate of someone close to you? Say if you know you have reason to believe that you're, well, let's pick on my poor brother here, who's no reason to not trust him, but what if I were to start to say, you know, well, you know, I don't know how well his business is doing, you know, maybe, you know, he's short of funds, and so maybe I start to not trust that he's got this responsibility. How should that be dealt with?
Well, I mean, I think first off, you probably need to address your brother, for instance, with your concerns. And if there's, you know, kind of going back to that family and friends discussion that we had before, really expressing your concerns on what may be going on and, you know, seeing how far you can get with that particular situation. If they're still not open and honest, you may want to, you know, like I said, bring in a third-party mediator and, you know, kind of talk it out and see what's going on, what the problem is. How can we, you know, if they're not sharing information, which they should be doing as a fiduciary, seeing if there's ways to engage the person a little bit more, not hopefully not putting them off too much, but trying to gather as much information as possible from that person. It all comes to, you know, trying to get as much shared information and open communication as you can with that particular person.
Excellent. Now, earlier, I think that you alluded to this, the thing that the Department of Justice has been trying to enact, which is, I think, called a fiduciary standard for retirement plan advisors. Is that what you were referring to earlier when you were talking about the...
financial abuse?
Right.
Yes. Yes, they're trying to get some standards in place to basically look at ways to curb financial abuse, looking at agencies. The Consumer Protection Bureau is one of them that has put out a lot of material to help people look out for these particular situations and how to avoid them and where to go for help and things like that, and legislation that will be able to assist a little bit better as well. So, you know, it's one of those things that and that's out there. A lot of people are aware that it's out there. It's getting a lot more, let's say, press and information than it was in the past, because a lot of people were probably being taken advantage of or exploited in this particular situation but didn't know where to go for help or where to turn. So it's a lot more dialogue going on right now in the particular area. So, I mean, it's a good thing that I see. And I think that comes out of, you know, just what we had talked about, boomers who are aging into retirement. There's going to be a lot more of us out here and a lot more of this going on. Something has to be done. So, you know, I think it's a good time to kind of lay some of this information out and, you know, good information for people to absorb so they can become more aware of how to become a better fiduciary, but also look out for some of these other things, such as financial exploitation and consumer scams that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've got one question. This is a situation that happened with me. My first husband died when my children were young, and so I received the proceeds of a significantly sized life insurance policy of his, and of course the purpose of my receiving that policy was in order to take care of the children. And shortly after I received the proceeds of that life insurance policy, I needed to figure out where to put it. You know, how do I best invest this money? So I engaged a financial advisor, and I was quite happy with the financial advisor the first year that I worked with him. But after a year, then he was telling me, well, you know, I think it would be better if we put that money, instead of where you have it right now, let's put it into this other vehicle. And I started to realize that I didn't know if I could actually trust him, because I believed that he probably was making commissions on the sale when he was recommending a vehicle where the money should be invested. So I don't have anything against a financial advisor who can earn commissions from their advice, but how do you protect yourselves and make sure that you can trust this person that you select?
Well, I mean, the person that you select, I mean, that I went back with trying to, I mean, in their particular situation, they kind of did a 360 on you after that first year, so that's a little different. But going in to a relationship, making sure you ask all the questions, how they're compensated, you know, have they had any, you know, especially you can go to brokercheck.org or .com, I believe, through FINRA, and they'll show you every financial advisor or broker that's out there, if they have a clean record, if they've had any complaints, if they have any blemishes on their record. I always hand that out to my clients if they request it, because I have nothing to hide. So really looking at that disclosure, being upfront with that particular person. So asking these questions like, you know, is it okay if I got a copy of your, you know, FINRA record? So they'll either say yes or no. If they are a little scared about it, then there may be something on there. And then if not, even you can, you know, at least you ask them that question so they could provide it for you. But you can still go on and do broker check anyway on your own as well, so you can see what the history of this particular person is. So if there is situations where on that particular broker check report that there has been complaints of churning, or if churning means basically putting your investment someplace else and getting the commission and then moving it someplace else and getting the commission. So basically churning your account to get commission somehow, some way. So if there's a history of that going on, or if there's been a complaint on that, then that will pop up on BrokerCheck, and you'll see that. So basically looking at doing a little more research, of course, disclosure is key with financial advisors. So ask them, you know, so, okay, we're here. Why all of a sudden are you recommending this? And then if they can explain why they're moving it, in your best interest, backing on your best interest, I think we should move it from A because I think B will do XYZ for you in your particular financial plan. They have to have some rationale on moving it for you and be able to explain that particular move for you. So really outlining the advice and the strategy and the recommendation and how is it benefiting you versus am I going to get, you know, X commission on that particular trade. But I would probably, of course, all of the disclosure, asking the questions, do a check if you feel a little uncomfortable that something deeper may be going on with any complaints that they may have had, and then, of course, having them outline the recommendation and strategy and why the move, or why are you recommending this How is it benefiting me? That's kind of basically, I guess, is always what is it going to do for me? You always
right.
have to kind of ask that particular situation. When mm-hmm. it's because everything, you know, kind of going back, I guess we kind of went full circle, going back to the fiduciary as your financial advisor is a fiduciary, has to act in your best interest, and what those particular recommendations need to do is explain why is this in my best interest, why is this in your best interest. So really mm-hmm. going back to how does it relate to me and why now.
All right. Excellent on that. Let's see. I'm not seeing any other questions that have come in for us this evening. Pam, is there anything that we've discussed in passing that you'd like to cover in any more depth?
No, I think we covered pretty much the major parts. And, you know, as you can see, I'm very passionate about this topic because
uh-huh.
you know, a lot of it, you know, I've experienced it in my own family with, you know, being having parents taken advantage of in this particular situation. And like I said, it's become quite the situation lately where a lot of it is going on, and I'm glad it's becoming more of a dialogue. And when we decided to do this particular call and this topic, I was really excited and engaged in it because I think a lot of people need to know what's going on, how to be better fiduciaries, but also keep an eye out for the person that their money that they're handling, that they're not being exploited or they're not being taken advantage of with some of these scams that are going on. And then also where to go for help, because a lot of times,
mm-hmm.
sometimes you become a fiduciary and a lot of it's maybe dumped on you and you're like, you know, really burdened, but there's resources that are available to you. You can go and find out from a lot of these particular agencies on how to do that, how to deal with conflict and family. So I think we covered pretty much everything we needed to do on the topic.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, and I do appreciate that you gave all those resources and website addresses for where to get help, because I think that there's only so much that we can cover in our hour here, and hopefully
mm-hmm.
anyone who's listening who has further questions, that would be one of the first places that they should go to look for more information. So given that I don't see any more questions right now, I'm going to finish things up here and say, as
okay.
usual, you've offered wonderful information. I thank you for being our guest expert on this topic and for this excellent discussion. And
thank you.
I thank everyone else who's been listening for joining us on the call with Pamela Sams. If you have any questions after the call, as usual, I believe, Pam, that you would allow people to
mm-hmm.
email them to you at pamela@jacksonsams.com.
Yes.
And if they would like to know anything more about the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, of course, I'll just give them a little bit of a notification about how to find us, which is we have some good websites. One of them is nabbw.com. We have a forum at boomerwomenspeak.com, and we have a Facebook page at facebook.com/NABBW. So, again, any questions in the future on this that you didn't get a chance to contact us and post, and I do have the lines open, so anybody could have asked a question who didn't want to type one in. So
mm-hmm.
I think that I'm going to say thank you to everyone for joining us tonight, and good night, and we'll talk to you again next month, Pam.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.